Kia ora to you all, and welcome to our first webinar of 2024. It's great to have Matilda Hamilton back to explore oncology emergencies in the rural context. This session is supported by the Section of Rural Health Department of General Practice at the University of Otago and the Division of Rural Hospital Medicine within the Rural New Zealand College of General Practitioners. It is endorsed for 1 hour of CME. We want this session to be as interactive as possible, as it can be within this format. We obviously have that chat session and chat format, and we've got Gary here who will collate the questions and put them to Matilda as we go through the cases. I will hand over to Matilda, looking forward to our session this evening, and I'll let you begin.
Thanks very much, Lucinda. So my name's Matilda Hamilton. For those of you I've not met before, I'm a rural hospital doctor who went to the dark side, and I'm completing my physician training here at Rotorua Hospital, having worked, done most of my training in the South Island and worked at Taupo Hospital. And I guess I hope to bring to you the knowledge that I've gained from being an oncology registrar for a total of 12 months now, and the pragmatism of working in the rural setting. So I don't claim to be an oncologist, so I really hope that this is practical tips. And I think the thing is with CME is it's not like I'm going to be introducing lots of new material. It's really reminders and bringing to the sort of the forefront of your mind things that you may not encounter on a very frequent basis, but are very important when you do come across them. So a lot of this is about recognition and actually thinking of diagnoses rather than any kind of complex management that can really be carried out in most of the contexts that you work in. So I'm going to work through a series of cases. I'm not going to cover the topics at the beginning that I'm going to go over because I feel like that'll give away any surprises that might lie within these cases. But I would ask you to contribute diagnoses and things to the chat box or just write on your own bit of paper because it definitely helps your brain if you're thinking of your own diagnoses for these situations. Moving on to my first case, and this is basically is loosely on cases that I've encountered either working at Taupo or patients who come to Rotorua from a rural context. So this is a 63-year-old woman who came from a small rural community. She worked in the local dairy. She considered herself usually well, but had been a smoker for most of her adult life. She'd experienced back pain and actually had multiple presentations to this to various health practitioners and just described this progressive difficulty with her walking. And she couldn't really be more specific than that. She just found it more and more difficult to walk. So I just was going to, I won't do this with each case, but for this one, Lucinda, I just thought I'd ask for your ideas about what we'd really want to hone in on in the history of this patient. Okay, smoker, got this back pain and complaining about some difficulty walking. Just from your point of view, what would be the key things in the history?
We'd do a wee bit more of a back pain history, and so just get some more features around that. And yeah, so constitutional symptoms, any sort of night sweats, any weight loss, or for food. And I suppose you'd also be just looking at past medical history and seeing what had happened to her in the past, if there was any family history. Obviously, we're doing oncology, so any family history or personal history of cancer. And then exploring the back a wee bit more, just I always do looking at red flags. So any symptoms of bowel or bladder or lower limb weakness or numbness. So them off the top of my head.
Yep, no, that's really good. And I think the things I really want to draw out of that is really those red flags, that most of the back pain that we see is in fact a benign cause. But if we really keep alert for those red flags, it'll give us clues. So there were a few with her. She did have some weight loss. And the real thing for her was that her back pain was continuous. Even at nighttime when she was in bed, she just had this ongoing pain. The key things on her examination were that she did have bilateral leg weakness and it was more proximal than distal, and she had reduced reflexes. So I guess with this patient, it's becoming pretty apparent that she did in fact have a spinal cord compression. And unfortunately, that was how she was diagnosed with her malignancy. So that's not an all uncommon thing. So the key here was that this was actually a patient that this had even been missed at her presentation. So the junior doctor who admitted this patient hadn't really identified this as a possible issue, and it wasn't identified until later in the day on a ward round. So we were both breaking the news of this to this patient that she likely had cord compression based on a CT scan and that this likely represented a new malignancy. So I guess the things that need to run through your mind when you're dealing with a patient like this is even in Rotorua Hospital, we need to think about where did this patient need to go? And that is going to be driven a lot by your local services. So Lucinda and I were talking about this last evening that where these patients are going to go is going to depend on where you can get the imaging and the management that you need. If you're working in a place like Taupo or Dunstan, this patient needs to be going to the place where they can get an MRI spine, which is the ideal investigation, and you want to image their entire spine. If a CT scan and you had access to that is going to provide you with some information to help your decision making, then by all means use that. But really, this patient needs an MRI. Ideally, your hospital or where you're working will actually have a pathway for malignant spinal cord compression. We do a recently formed one within our hospital so that it's orthopedics speaking to orthopedics, but I'm sure that varies across the country. And depending where you work, it may be that you're speaking to the patient's oncologist themselves. You may be speaking to neurosurgery or orthopedics or radiation oncology. So I can't really give you a kind of one size fits all. It will be dependent across the country who you need to speak to. But I'm sure if you raise this as a possible diagnosis, whoever you're speaking to on the phone will point you in the right direction. The definitive treatment for the patient will also be very dependent on their malignancy, on their age, on their comorbidities, on what their prognosis is like. This is either going to be operative management under an orthopedic or neurosurgical team, or looking at radiation oncology, which is used more and more. You can actually use quite low dose radiation oncology, or it may be that this is really at the end stage of a patient's journey through their malignancy, and it may be that it's local management and symptom management, which is key rather than transporting them across the country. So that's going to really need to be a team decision. But I think the things I'd stress is the conversations need to be had early, and if action's going to be taken, transport needs to be arranged quickly. Otherwise, it's a joint decision to keep the patient locally. In the meantime, if there's any clinical suspicion of this diagnosis, the one thing you can do which can make a difference is getting some dexamethasone on board quickly, and that's doses of about 16 milligrams. The other kind of aspects to malignant spinal cord compression is that patients can range from being asymptomatic to presenting with full paralysis. The cancers that you have really high suspicion for are lung, breast, multiple myeloma, and renal. But in fact, any malignancy can do this. So you just need to keep your suspicion levels high. And unfortunately, it's how 20% of people initially present with their malignancy. So it's quite traumatic, the double blow of having a pretty serious mobility threatening or neurological threatening event and being told that you have malignancy. And I guess that this is a real true oncological emergency in so far as early intervention can make the difference between a patient maintaining their independence or left unable to walk or bedbound. So there's certainly quite a bit of diagnostic delay in this area, and that makes a big difference because if patients present and they're still able to walk, then there's a high likelihood that with some treatment they'll be able to continue walking. So this is a Danish study from the 90s that those who could ambulate at diagnosis, the vast majority could continue to ambulate once they had treatment in place, whereas those who presented who already had impaired mobility or couldn't walk, only 18% regained that capability. And if we look over the years, this is looking at UK data, then from compared 1998 to 2010, there's a significant improvement in those who were presenting ambulatory. So that is representing a reduction in delay to diagnosis. And that was due to significant education campaigns, but also institution of pathways within different areas so that there was, you know, clinician awareness of this, but also streamlined pathways to get patients the imaging that they needed and the intervention that they needed. And I guess that's what we can focus on in a local way, like finding out what we do with these patients if we have this suspicion. And the oncologist I work with, he has the mantra of walk in, walk out. If we can diagnose our patients at the stage that they're still walking, then there's a high chance that they'll be able to continue walking. And I guess just going back to the things that Lucinda was asking, none of this is new, but just reiterating that really thinking about people's bowel and bladder function, having a higher suspicion if people have got bilateral leg symptoms, obviously saddle anesthesia, and then those systemic symptoms of loss of appetite and that unremitting nature of the pain. Or a historic diagnosis of cancer, even if it's breast cancer years ago, that needs to make me more suspicious. Lucinda, that reminds me, last night you asked me about how we actually differentiate around that bowel and bladder issue.
I think the way we ask that question of our patients and to trying to determine, because orthopedics often have a slightly different interpretation. So it's just trying to determine exactly if what we are seeing is a symptom of cauda equina, the bowel and bladder symptoms. So how do we ask that, or how do we interpret that, or have you got any pointers on that?
Sure. So I think just one thing there, that it isn't always just about cauda equina that can cause bladder and bowel dysfunction. So even if you've got lesions higher up the spine, you can get compromised with your bowel and bladder function. So I think with the bladder and probably with the bowel, I think asking really explicit questions like around people's sensation when they're actually voiding or passing a bowel motion. I think constipation can be overlooked in these patients. Incontinence, obviously. I think we can be a bit misled by bladder. So for instance, I had a patient the other day who had cord compression and she had said, I'm still passing urine. I've been going to the toilet and I'm passing urine. But then when we actually did a bladder scan, she had this huge bladder and she had incomplete emptying for some time and her bladder had got quite stretched. So it certainly wasn't functioning normally. So I think that's one of those things you do need to dig a little deeper on if you have that suspicion. And a bladder scan is certainly a simple bedside tool, or using the ultrasound to make sure that patients are actually emptying their bladder properly. And I really think that bilateral leg symptoms, that always makes me quite nervous.
Thanks.
So I just coming back to that point I was just making with Lucinda, is that I think from medical school and even as practicing doctors, we get quite focused on cauda equina. But remember that lesions can occur anywhere in the spinal column and patients can have quite different neurological signs. When we're thinking of cauda equina, we're typically thinking of that kind of flaccid paralysis and that decreased absent reflexes that fit with kind of lower motor neuron signs. But that can be quite different if you've got a higher cord compression. Say, for instance, if they might have quite a spastic paralysis and actually quite brisk reflexes. And that can give us a clue and just remind us that we need to be thinking about imaging the whole cord. And it may be that the cord compression doesn't even correlate with where the patient's experiencing their back pain. Patients with lumbar spine pain and neurology, in fact, when we image their spine, their lesion's actually really high up in the spine. You may have missed if you only imaged a fragment of the cord. And just remember that not all cord compression will present with urinary retention in fecal incontinence, particularly if it's higher up in the cord. You may not get that with every presentation. So just thinking about the management, I really won't dwell on this too much because it really is at a specialist level, tertiary level, of if this intervention is going to occur. But I think the local things that you can think about doing is administration of steroids, even if you've just got clinical suspicion, no one's ever going to criticise you for that. Getting pain relief on board. Clexane, because these patients are at high risk of DVT, they've got a malignancy and they're going to be lying around, and then giving them that tummy protection as well with omeprazole and so forth. So I think, without meaning to sound like I'm teaching you to suck eggs, I just want to emphasise the neuro exam is really helpful. I think sometimes we don't realise how useful that is and to just trust the findings that we're getting. But the other reason I say that is anyone you're about to speak to on the phone, whether it's a neurosurgical registrar or an orthopaedic registrar, is going to really ask you a lot about that exam because you're the surrogate person carrying that exam out for them. So that if I've had those conversations and I've been like, they're like, what are the planters doing? Have they got clonus? And I'm like, I didn't actually check. And I think if you're just really well prepared with a good exam, and then you're sort of the advocate for your patient, and it's going to help that clinician make the right decision about the urgency of transfer and getting an MRI, if that's in a weekend and that kind of thing. The other learning tip, having seen a few of these now, is they don't present as obviously as you might think they would. And we think of classically of weakness, but it may be that they just come in complaining of tripping or being clumsy, or they've noticed they're really constipated despite our treatment. Passing urine is more difficult. They're just not managing as well at home, or it may only be the back pain and the neurological symptoms may be about to manifest in the days and weeks ahead. So I think just having it as always a suspicion with those cancer patients. I think I've harped on about the need to image the whole spine before and the MRI is best. And I think that influences choosing the right hospital. So, for instance, transferring to Rotorua Hospital on the weekend for one of these patients is not the best because we've got no MRI access. Really, they should be going straight to Waikato, and you guys will have more sense of your local area. And again, if they have cancer, have a low suspicion. So I think to make you know how suspicious we are, we do a lot of imaging that ends up being normal within, when I was doing oncology, because we have such a low suspicion that's fine, that some of these patients are in fact not going to have cord compression. You need negative imaging in order to capture all these patients. Anything else on that, Lucinda, before I move on to the next case?
Hannah has just asked about, is there any benefit in doing a plain x-ray?
Do you know, I honestly, the only reason I would do it is if you thought it was going to be like leverage to get your patient where you wanted to get them. So if you could see really awful changes at a certain level and you thought it represented kind of cancer at that level and you thought that was going to be a useful tool, I think so. But I don't think it's in any way going to reassure you that they don't have cord compression, for instance, because you might see that they've got a compression fracture or something like that. But if that patient's got cancer, it may be that fracture is a manifestation of their malignancy, but you can't see what's actually happening at the level of the cord. So I think it's more going to add to your case rather than give you a definition.
Or if it looks normal, it might falsely reassure you.
Yeah, exactly, because you don't know what's happening in that canal and it's not going to show you soft tissue change.
Matilda, I just want to alter your scenario just really slightly because I think it's a relatively common presentation.
Yep.
So say the patient hasn't got any neurological signs whatsoever.
Yeah.
Despite your absolute best efforts to try and find something because you're highly suspicious. So
yeah.
It's a patient with a known cancer. They've got back pain and their only sort of symptom is they just say that they have found increasing difficulty walking. They just feel unsteady, just not right on their feet.
Yep.
How suspicious are you about that one? And given the fact it's a weekend and the MRI scan is a long way away.
So, yeah, I'd still be super suspicious. And the things I'd say is I'd probably also with that story be worried about scanning their head too. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's like what I was saying earlier on about the walk-in, walk-out, because it's so much better to capture this before they've actually got cord compression and they've got neurological deficit that you really want to push to get that imaging. I think in that situation, say in Dunstan, I think it would be completely okay to be doing a CT in the weekend if that's going to help. Like MRI is gold standard, but CT's also got a role to play. And I think if you have a conversation with the right person, you're going to get the help that you need in that situation over a weekend. So if you talk to a junior medical registrar, they're probably going to deflect you away. Whereas if you speak to an SMO on call or the orthopedic surgeon on call, I think you're going to get the answer or the help that you need more quickly. And it may be that if they don't have absolute neurology, they may say, look, let's transfer them for the right imaging in the next 24 hours or Monday morning rather than doing it urgent. But I think that I'd still be pushing pretty hard for that patient.
Cool. Yep. Yeah, thanks for that. I agree. I think if you leave it till Monday, most of those patients may well have missed the boat on.
Yeah. And I don't think I really got that until I saw a few cases who the boat had been missed. There was a delay in their diagnosis and they were left unable to walk. And yeah, you don't forget those experiences. I think I'll move on to case number two now. So this is a 54-year-old man who's got a diagnosis of metastatic renal cell carcinoma. So he's recently been demonstrated to have progression on first-line therapy, but he has been considered second-line therapy, whatever that's worth. And he's got known intra-abdominal malignancy. I think he had liver mets and known bony mets as well. So his presentation was that of abdominal pain. So this one, I just jot a few ideas of what you'd be thinking in this patient. So abdominal pain, his bowels had not opened for 4 days. He has experiencing nausea. And his family described him as being a bit drowsy and certainly fatigued at home. This patient had, in fact, hypercalcemia. I think some of the other thoughts when this patient presented was whether or not they might have a bowel obstruction, which is completely reasonable, that they may, in fact, just be really constipated from their treatment. And the drowsiness and things was raising suspicion for whether or not that might have brain metastases. But it was good because someone checked a calcium, and I think that's probably one of my take-home points from this little section on hypercalcemia is that have such a low threshold for checking the calcium, I think in all patients, but particularly oncology patients, because their presentation of hypercalcemia can be so vague and so variable that if we don't include it in that workup of bloods, then it can easily be overlooked or the diagnosis can be delayed. So just thinking which malignancies are most likely to either present first time with hypercalcemia or develop it during the course of the illness, that multiple myeloma, breast cancer, lung, renal, and thyroid. And I think it's always a bit hard to know when to worry, like number-wise. So I think patients can start to develop symptoms once their calcium gets above 3. So that's when it's clinically likely to be significant. And then once it gets into the realm of 4+, you're getting into a life threat and you might need to be thinking about more urgent management. And as I said, the symptoms can be really quite vague. Those are the classic ones that people are taught. But I admitted a patient last week, a young guy with hypercalcemia, and his only real symptoms were polyuria and polydipsia, and he'd had some weight loss. So quite rightly, people were wondering if he had developed diabetes. But in fact, it was just his calcium was roaring through the roof. But he didn't really have any other symptoms to go with it. I think it's just a good one to include. Later on, manifestations can be seizure and arrhythmia and weakness and coma. This is when the numbers start getting quite high. Just for a bit of background again to remind you why cancer patients get high calcium. So some tumours produce the parathyroid-related peptide, and that's really just an awareness. We don't actually check for that hormone. If you want to check it, it has to be sent to Australia and you get it weeks later. So it's really an academic exercise. And the presence of skeletal metastases can push your calcium up, and then in some situations you're going to get reduced clearance. And I think just to remember that obviously not all hypercalcemia is driven by cancer. So most commonly it's going to be things like hyperparathyroidism or some other kind of granulomatous disorder. Some patients who've got malignancy may have another cause like hyperparathyroidism happening at the same time. So it's worth checking the parathyroid hormone levels.
Matilda, there's a question there from David just about those places have just got an iStat available, and what you get is you get a ionised calcium. Have you got any? That might be a slightly unfair question for you given where you're working, but.
Yeah, you're probably no better than me, Gary. Like, as in its accuracy or its comparability to those numbers that I was saying before?
Probably as much as anything, it's comparability.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd be the best person to answer that. Does anyone out there know? They can write it in the chat box if they...
There's a few people out there who I know rely on iStats out of ours.
Like say at your big hospital that you are referring to, you could always get hold of the laboratory, that laboratory at nighttime, and they'd probably be able to do some equivalents, or there's probably online equivalency tools or something you could use.
I know the upper limit of normal in our lab is 2.55. That's the upper limit of normal of a blood lab calcium level. But I don't know what it is for a iStat. Mark just said in there, he thinks it's relatively similar, but he thinks it's a different reference range.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't, because I've got so reliant on just having the...
And then the iStat machine, it doesn't give you a reference range, so you end up having to Google. Like, I recommend doing that occasionally. Cody's out there. Do you have any idea, Cody?
No, nothing more than anyone else said, but it's still really good to have it because it gives you something.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And especially because you can do a serial one.
Yep.
And then do lab one in the morning, so always really useful.
Yep. So I think the things that we need to couple along with this hypercalcemia is check the patient's renal function. So often they're going to have a coupled acute kidney injury as a result of their hypercalcemia. That chap I was talking about the other day certainly did. Stop any supplements. So patients may be taking separate non-prescribed medications. That's a good thing to check. And hold any medications that might further impair their renal function. In the initial instance, it's just about starting fluids. And you can go, if a patient can tolerate it, you may be giving them up to 2 or 3 litres a day. And this is just trying to bring that calcium down into a level that's either safe or reducing the symptoms. You want to be able to get some bisphosphonate on board. We usually use zoledronic acid. That you need to be careful with their renal function. With certain EGFRs, it's not actually safe to give the bisphosphonate. So you normally need to wait for some improvement. That's not going to have immediate effect, but it does last for a number of weeks. And that often allows the patient to then, if this is a new diagnosis or early on, for their treatment to be instituted, their chemotherapy and things, which is ultimately the best treatment. Treat the cancer, treat the driver of what's pushing the calcium up, but the zoledronic acid will buy you some time. I've had patients who've needed to have the zoledronic acid on a number of occasions, so it may only be spaced by a matter of months. Someone rang me the other day and asked me about calcitonin, and I had to look how useful this is for oncology-driven hypercalcemia. And apparently it's not really recommended. It has a reasonably rapid onset, but it doesn't last particularly long.
How often would you continue testing the calcium, like acutely and then ongoing from like when would you repeat it? And
yeah, so I guess it depends on what kind of number you're dealing with. So for that chap I admitted a guy over the weekend, his was 3.8, for instance, and he had an acute kidney injury. And we decided to not really recheck it until, I think we checked it, so admitted him Friday, recheck it Sunday, because you want to give a decent amount of time for the medication to take effect. But then I guess once he's gone home, he hasn't got a diagnosis, but after having some bisphosphonate and things, you probably want to be checking it on a weekly basis, maybe more frequently at the beginning to see the trajectory of what it's going to do, and then reasonably often until they get started on their hopefully effective treatment, whatever that is going to be ultimately.
We also talked about osteonecrosis of the jaw with the bisphosphonate.
Oh, yeah.
I mentioned it to you.
Yeah, so this is, everyone knows this rare diagnosis of osteonecrosis of the jaw. So I think it's about risk stratification of your patients, because obviously even in the ideal situation, it's hard to get a dental review of your patients, and certainly in a rural place, and it's going to be hard to be able to get full risk stratification of your patients. So I think for the most part, if your patient's got reasonable dental health and they don't have active pathology going on within their mouth, I think it's safe to go ahead. With our oncology patients, like for instance, like the breast cancer patients end up getting zoledronic acid every 6 months for a number of years. So we will get them to get a dental clearance because you're giving them quite a bit of medication. But I think in the first instance, if you've got something that's really making people symptomatic or dangerous, then I think that has to take precedence, getting the bisphosphonate in there. And I think just warning people that it may not be a medication, if you're largely a hospital doctor, you may not administer all the time. Just warning people that it can make them feel really crappy for about 24 hours, like flu-like, but that will wear off reasonably quickly.
Yeah, 100%. We always give them, when we give them in the community, that 2 to 3 days of flu-like symptoms, take some paracetamol.
Mm.
And good.
And it's very real, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Matilda, I was just going to ask you about fluids.
Yeah.
A lot of these patients can be really dry when you first see them.
Yep.
On occasion, you may perhaps need to be a lot more aggressive initially than just the 2 to 3 litres that you've mentioned there.
I probably didn't say that quite accurately. So I guess you need to often fluid resuscitate, and then that just needs to be then your maintenance kind of fluid over several days. So I think that for that chap I was talking about, I think we gave him in his first 24 hours, he probably had 4 litres or more, and then we put him on that number of litres for the kind of following days. So I think if you think about it in two steps, the fluid resuscitation, volume resuscitation, and then that maintenance dose just while you're trying to get their calcium down a bit.
And just the type of fluid, there's a real vogue where we are now to go for Hartmann's. But someone younger and clever might know if there's a bit of calcium in Hartmann's.
Yeah, with this guy, Ron has it. I just went for like Hartmann's, normal saline, Hartmann's. Just keeping both camps happy. But I think probably if you're giving those kind of fluids, probably if you're talking to an intensive care, I think that, or Jono would be saying probably Hartmann's would be a better option to just avoid that large chloride load. The other thing I'd say is that for some of these patients, this will be part of the terminal part of their illness. So this may be their cancer is escalating and becoming out of control. And it may be that it's the palliative care team that's really going to be giving you advice, or you may be that palliative care team. And it may be that you shift much more towards focusing on symptom management rather than chasing a number and bringing that calcium down, because it may just be part of the kind of natural progression of that malignancy if there's not really any other treatment options available. Any other things for hypercalcemia, Lucinda?
No.
Moving on to our next case. This is a 40-year-old woman who's had a long-standing stage 4 metastatic colorectal cancer. She's had many years of chemotherapy and multiple interventions along the way, had a torrid time of it. She remains on chemotherapy, and she had her last dose 11 days ago. She presented feeling unwell with really quite vague symptoms. She was significantly hypotensive, shocked there, tachycardic. She had a temperature of 36. She looked pale and she was a bit drowsy and couldn't give us all that much history. She was of note, we had limited bloods to start with, but her hemoglobin was quite shockingly 45. She had a high lactate and the rest of it was pending. So just if you think of your various differentials there, I mean, I guess there's some obvious things there, given that she's got a hemoglobin of 45 and she's quite shocked. But there's other things that we should be considering in this setting. So just give your brain a second to ponder those things. So, and then it wasn't really super obvious, and everyone's focus was very much on this patient's shock and her low hemoglobin, and the immediate thought was that she was maybe having some bleeding from somewhere, and that was a reasonable thought. And so it actually went for half an hour before anyone was like, oh, hold on, it may be that this woman actually has sepsis driving her hypotension. And I think sometimes it's going to be really obvious when your oncology and chemotherapy patients have sepsis and they're going to come in with a raging temperature. But I think it's one of those things that you just have to have a really low threshold for being suspicious of. And it may be that the hypotension may be your only clue. So I think this patient, she was okay from an airway and breathing point of view. And she certainly needed fluid resuscitation. And I guess in this kind of situation, it would be ideal to actually get blood into her as your resuscitative fluid, but that's not always going to be available. So whatever your kind of local, your rural hospital has, that may not be any blood product, and you may just have to opt for fluids. And I think the key here with the thinking about sepsis in these patients is the real importance of getting cultures off early and getting antibiotics in early. And that is so important because it makes a difference to mortality, and patients do better if they get antibiotics within that first hour. There's good evidence for that. I think the other key things is that you need to get cultures from as many places as you can, but don't let that compromise getting the antibiotics in. So, for instance, if you've got a patient who's got a port, but no one in your service knows how to actually support, don't panic if you can't get bloods off that particular line. That shouldn't prevent you from giving antibiotics. Just get as many usual kind of peripheral cultures, two sets off, try and get some urine off, and then just label really carefully where the sets of cultures come from. So if it's taken from a PIC line, for instance, but just make sure that's been clearly labelled by whoever's taking the bloods. This is the peripheral cultures. And obviously this particular patient would not be someone that you'd keep within your hospital particularly long, but it may be that within your service, more straightforward patients with sepsis in the setting of chemotherapy, whether that be neutropenic or not, it may be appropriate that you do keep them locally. So I put the neutropenic of this title, I put in brackets, because you're not always going to know whether these patients are neutropenic or not. So you're going to have a patient who's got cancer, who's on chemotherapy, that you don't necessarily know if they're in the neutropenic phase of their chemotherapy or if they've been neutropenic at all, but we just treat them as if they are until we know otherwise. I think the real key thing is that these patients need to be seen rapidly. And this is something you can do within your own service that can make a real difference, is making sure that you have systems in place, that the nursing staff are schooled up on the importance of this, that they get triaged quickly, and that doctors, other than the medical staff or whoever's seeing them, is alerted early to them being in your department, in your hospital, in your clinic, so that the action can start happening. Just a reminder that neutropenia is a neutrophil count less than 0.5, or those who are really at risk of having low neutrophils. And that most often is in kind of that later phase of the chemotherapy cycle. So it was mid to late cycle. So usually it's 2 to 3 weeks between chemotherapy doses. And they usually drop their neutrophils in that kind of day 10, 12 period. A temperature, all the patients are told a temperature of greater than 38 or 38.5, but that's not always true. So sometimes they'll present septic with no temperature at all. Sometimes they'll be cold. So don't let that put you off thinking of sepsis as a possibility. And of course, it may be that they have just got off. One of their vital signs might be off. They might just be tachypnea or tachycardia. And I think I mentioned this high CRP, just such a vague thing Lucinda pointed out to me, but I think that in these patients, just an isolated high CRP without other signs and symptoms to go with it is going to make you really quite suspicious that they've got bacteremia. And that's really what we're looking at with these patients. So they may not have an obvious site or source of infection when you examine them and when you do your maybe chest x-ray. And that's because the thing that we're really concerned about is bacteremia, and that's not going to become apparent until they've blood cultures have grown something, and that's why we often just have to get the antibiotics in before we know what we're dealing with. Just moving on to the management side of things, I'm kind of saying the same thing over and over again, but that's because it's the crux of it, is to culture broadly and quickly and get those antibiotics in. And this is like my The oncologist I worked with said it's one of, when he was an oncology registrar, it was one of the few things that he really used to go with the nurses and help them draw out the antibiotics and go back to the patient and make sure the antibiotics get administered. And that's because it's so easy within a setting like this when you're worried about a patient for half an hour to slip away, concentrating on other things, and then you realise that the antibiotics haven't got in, so making that one of your absolute priorities. For the most part, in our guidelines recommend TAS or tazacin, and that's for its very broad spectrum. And that's really dependent on what you've got access to. And I would think, and you might want to comment, Gary, about what you've got available to you. But I guess if within your hospital you don't have that, it's important that you know what you would give as guided by your local infectious disease that you've got access to. Would most hospitals have that in stock, do you think?
Yeah, Sydney, down south, that'd be the case. And in fact, I'm pretty sure that we make sure it's supplied for some outlying GPs such as Wanaka.
That's been my experience up here, that most places have access to it. I just had some tips from Jared Green today, who's a rural doctor and infectious disease doctor. And one of the things he said, just remember that although PIT-TAS has got really broad spectrum, it doesn't cover MRSA. So if you've got a suspicion about MRSA from maybe previously having MRSA, then you do need to broaden that and think about like using vancomycin and things. And if people have severe penicillin allergy, your next step would be meropenem. If you didn't have that on site, then I think you'd need to be getting advice from local ID or clinical microbiology as to what would be the next best thing that you had in your hospital. I don't think that really anything else there needs spelling out. Other than saying that if these patients are really unwell, they're probably going to need to be transferred out, but not, you know, you're going to treat them aggressively to begin with, but not all of them are going to necessarily need transferring out if it all sort of, some of these patients will have a temperature, everything will settle down, the bloods won't look too bad, and you may be satisfied to even send them home like on oral augmentin, but not all of them are going to be so crashing out well. And I'm just reminded just to think of other causes of shock in this setting. And that was tips from Jared. I think he said the same. He just wrote about four times, culture, culture, culture. One of the things he wanted to say was that not all neutropenia is the same. So patients who have got hematological malignancies like leukemias and things, because of the chemo they get, they're much higher risk. They have a deeper neutropenia. They get lower neutrophil counts and for a much longer period of time. So they're much riskier patients. And he said that if you really do identify a source, so if it becomes very apparent they've got cellulitis or a chest infection, you may well be able to narrow your treatment down quite early on. And just that real emphasis on using your local guides, because hopefully that will match with your sensitivities. Oh, this is this table. I just wanted to share this table because I really like it for when I can never remember what antibiotic covers what from one day to the next. This is I just Google in Wellington antibiotic susceptibility or something, and it's just a really nice guide. But the thing I just wanted to emphasise with this illustration is that this is PIP-TAS here. So you've got this drug that just gives really broad gram-positive and gram-negative cover that doesn't cover MRSA. And that's what you want because you're so concerned about both gram-positive and gram-negative bacteria in these patients. Okay.
Matilda, there's just a question there from Dave just about the use of G-CSF.
Yep, that's a really good question. And so a lot of these patients, so just G-CSF, either filgrastim or pegfilgrastim, a lot of these patients will have received that during the chemotherapy cycle. And you can actually usually see if they do or not, because sometimes you won't have the letter or the patient won't remember, by going into NZ EPS and you can see if it's been actually dispensed. So I think a lot of patients will have got it, and it's questionable how much more you should give them. And I think if they've already had G-CSF, then you want to seek advice from their oncologist about whether they should, or hematologist about whether you should be giving more. Certainly, if someone's crashingly unwell and they're profoundly neutropenic, it's a good thought. And it's about whether you have that available to you or not. And I think I'd probably, if you're thinking about that, I think you're needing to be discussing that patient with an oncologist or hematologist, because you're obviously pretty worried about them. But it's another good thought. Does that answer it, Gary?
Yeah, thanks for that.
I'm saying I didn't mean to choose such young people, but I guess these are the cases that really stick in my mind. So this is a 36-year-old Māori woman who was sadly diagnosed with a metastatic stomach cancer, which you may recall there's a genetic form of stomach cancer in New Zealand that exists, and she was one of the unfortunate people to carry this gene. She had six cycles of chemotherapy, and she'd actually responded quite well on her initial scans, and she just presented feeling absolutely awful. She was having free syncope, low energy. She just looked horrible. Her observations weren't too bad, and there wasn't really too much to find on examining her, and her bloods didn't really shed much light on the situation. So what were we considering? To begin with, she hadn't had a scan for a while. So at first we thought, oh man, this is probably, she's got progression of her horrible cancer. We wondered about brain metastases, because you're always suspicious for that. We thought of the possibility of sepsis, and we wondered about PE. She also described feeling quite breathless when she was trying to move around the room. So we actually ended up scanning her. I slightly mistold you this, Lisa, last night. I came back to me what we actually did. So because we were so suspicious of progression, we did a CT. And unfortunately, that showed this finding. This is not her CT finding, but she went on to have an echo. So in fact, she had tamponade. So she developed a really significant pericardial effusion, even though she was responding to chemotherapy. And that was basically explaining her entire presentation. And it certainly wasn't at the top of our differentials, but I've really tried to tune into it. So I've had a few patients since then, but that's one of those possibilities when you've got either the really unwell or the shocked oncology patient, that there's the possibility that they've got tamponade. I think it's a great thing. You're not going to diagnose it often, but it's a good thing to be able to exclude, because you can use your ultrasound and your royal setting to check for that. And then when you're deciding what's best for your patient, it's one of those things that can guide you if you've excluded that. Another helpful tool is looking back at them. These patients get CT'd all the time, so they will have had a CT in the not too distant past, and you can see if they had a pericardial effusion then. So if they've got a small one 6 weeks ago, then that would give you more of a suspicion that I'd want them to be doing a bedside echo looking for that pericardial effusion. I don't think there's too much to say management-wise. You're going to need to be discussing this with a team. You've usually got a bit of time up your sleeve. You're not going to be able to rush to get these patients moved. And we were, you know, Lucinda was saying like about aspirating and doing pericardial centesis, but you know, that's only the situation that the patient's, you know, crashingly unwell and sort of dying in front of you, but you've usually got a bit of time up your sleeve. Even for palliative patients, draining these and potentially putting a window in can make them feel a whole heap better, even in sort of, but, you know, that's a decision that needs to be made. Do they want to travel to a tertiary hospital to get this intervention done, or is it really just a time for care? Moving on to case number 5, this is a 79-year-old woman who has a diagnosis of small cell lung cancer, and she'd had 3 cycles of chemotherapy. Despite her age, she was keen to have a bit of chemo. She'd responded well. She didn't have heaps of metastatic disease, so she'd actually elected to put her chemotherapy on pause and just enjoy the time that she had left. She unexpectedly presented, this is at a Taupo clinic, in a wheelchair, and she's feeling utterly exhausted. She was in bed all the time. She'd had quite significant weight loss, and she was starting to feel really unsteady on her feet. Examination-wise, she didn't really have anything particularly focal. She just looked really frail, and her bloods didn't shed too much light on things, remembering that it's not always the cancer. We checked her TSH, and that was okay. Her chest X-ray looked pretty unchanged. So just again, what could be going on in this setting? You start to think in a certain way. I thought she would have body-wide progression explaining why she felt so awful. But in fact, and sorry, these are other things we're thinking of, which, did she have sepsis? Could this be hypercalcemia? But in fact, it was the last problem. So I don't know if you remember that last time we talked about lung cancer, small cell lung cancer has a particular propensity to go to people's brain. So that made us more suspicious for that diagnosis. And that was what, in fact, this patient, she ended up having a chest abdo-pelvis with only mild progression of her disease, but she had multiple brain metastases with edema. Again, these patients, it's a really common manifestation of cancer. And if you've got suspicion of brain metastases, then the answer lies in neuroimaging, and you may have to transfer your patient out for that. If you've got the capacity to diagnose brain metastases, then you really have to think about who you're going to discuss that with. I'd say that if the patient's already got an oncologist, I think that would be your first port of call, and then having a discussion around the appropriateness of talking to neurosurgery. There's only a small proportion of patients who are going to be suitable for neurosurgery. and whether or not radiation oncology might be a better option from a symptom point of view, but we all know what the access to that is like in some parts of the country. So it might be that it's just too much of a wait. From our point of view, what can we do? Getting dexamethasone on board to reduce that edema and get patients feeling a little bit better. And someone asked me the other day about prophylactic anticonvulsants, and there's not a lot of evidence for this. For the most part, we can avoid that and avoid the side effects that might come from that. What kind of dosing for dexamethasone depends on the patient in front of you and how symptomatic they are, but looking in the realm of 8 milligrams, and they may need ongoing maintenance. Anything else on from the brain metastases point of view?
There's no questions in the chat.
Yeah.
Unless, Gary, you've got any.
No, there's nothing there, Matilda. Although, if you're finished on that topic, there's just one question that harked back to the previous topic. Can we ask that one? Yeah. And it was really around it's quite a good question, really. Most of the patients who have got a bit of a fever and who are neutropenic actually aren't particularly unwell. And there was the question there about which ones can we actually safely, if they look like they're just going to settle, send home. Is there a potentially on oral antibiotics? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the key things are that if they obviously don't have much physiological derangement, so if their blood pressure's okay, their heart rate's not too bad, and clinically I'd give yourself some time to observe them, how they're going to respond. And depending on what blood test you can access, but I think if you've shown that they're not actually neutropenic, so I think your neutropenic patients, you'd have a lower threshold for kind of observing and seeing how they go. And then I think that if your bloods look okay, your clinical examination, with time you're satisfied that things are going in the right direction, then I think sending them home on some oral antibiotics is going to be okay. But I think with a really strong safety net in place to make sure that they know when to represent. And then if you're really feeling a bit uncertain, I think it's fine to call the oncology team to run it past them. Like that, we get quite a few phone calls about that sort of thing, because I think you'd want to be sharing that sort of decision making.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So just a word on actual administration of dexamethasone. It doesn't matter too much which route you give it, as long as you're getting it in. So it can be taken orally. If not, it can be given intravenously over around 30 minutes. And then the subcut route, if you've got a patient where the intravenous access is difficult, just remember to give it reasonably slowly because it can sting. So I think that was all for the brain metastases. So the malignancies to think really strongly: lung, breast, melanoma, and renal, and particularly within lung, those small cell lung cancers are even more likely. Obviously, headache. Again, you just have to have such a low threshold with your oncology patients. Once you've ruled out the really simple causes of headache, and if the headache's persisting and it's new and it's different, then you have to think about getting neuroimaging, because otherwise your question is going to remain unanswered. Obviously, focal neurology is going to make you super suspicious. And I think unexplained nausea and vomiting. So it's quite easy to put people's nausea down to perhaps their chemotherapy or the fact they're constipated or side effects from other medications they're on. But if it's unremitting and you can't get on top of it, that may be the only clue that you've got that they've got NETs and they've got increased intracranial pressure. And it can make a real difference to people's how they actually feel. So I remember having a patient like this that she was in the last months of her life. But once we managed to get that diagnosis established, get her on some dexamethasone, the fact that we could then treat her nausea and bring her nausea down made the world of difference to her, even though we didn't do much else with her brain metastases as far as definitive treatment goes. And I think if people have got an unexplained deterioration, you need to include their brain if imaging is going to be arranged. And just a note there that they do need to be imaged with contrast, so you can miss metastases if you do imaging without contrast. So I think this is the last case I'm going to present. So this is a 64-year-old man who presents with breathlessness and weight loss. He's a smoker, but he also describes this feeling of facial fullness. And this was his, that doesn't project very well, but an X-ray showing a large new mass. And in this case, this was a diagnosis of superior vena cava obstruction. So I don't know if you remember the test we were taught at medical school was Pemberton sign. We get the patient to raise their arms up above their head and they get sort of engorgement of their face and they look very plethoric. And it can be a bit more subtle than that. Just remembering all those other causes of breathlessness in your oncology patients, that they're high risk of PE, anemia, of having an effusion or having infection. But breathlessness is not an uncommon way for these patients to present. They may also complain of stridor or change in their voice. They may get headache associated with kind of increased intracranial pressure. They may just describe their face changing colour. And then examining them, you may see those dilated collateral vessels in their chest and upper abdomen. They may not always have a malignancy at that site. So it can be that they've got compression from a tumour, but there is the potential also just for thrombus to form in the SVC, causing obstruction as well. First case I saw of this was in Dunstan Hospital, actually. And this was a patient who was at quite far through his malignancy, and we elected not to transfer him, but sought advice from his oncology team by the phone just for managing his symptoms. And I think the administration of kind of steroids was about as much as we could do, and just keeping him really comfortable and on anticoagulation for whatever it was worth. Again, this is about recognition and just having it in your mind. You're not going to see this very often, but it needs conversations around management outside of the rural hospital setting. Steroids have got a role to play to reduce edema, but it's definitely not definitive treatment. And ultimately, they need imaging to get a firm diagnosis. Anything else about the SVC?
No, I don't think so. Matilda, just as you say, highlighting it and just people being aware.
Yep. So finally, I was just going to touch on diarrhea in the oncology patient. And I think this is I've seen this kind of go wrong a few times, and it's a manifestation that needs to be taken really seriously. Most chemotherapy regimens actually cause patients to be constipated, and that's a combination of the chemo itself, but also the drugs that they get with the chemo, for instance, ondansetron and things. If you've got a patient with really significant diarrhea, that's the less common situation. I don't expect you guys to remember chemotherapy drug names or get too caught up in them. I did 12 months of oncology and I still struggle to remember the differences between the different drugs. But just to have an awareness of these two drugs, the first being irinotecan and the second being fluorouracil, which also gets called 5-FU and also comes in an oral formulation of capecitabine. And as Lucinda pointed out to me yesterday, is also the ingredient in Efudex, which you may come across as a topical treatment of skin malignancies. So first of all, irinotecan, which is commonly used for gastrointestinal malignancies, can cause a really sudden onset profuse diarrhea. And that really needs involvement of the oncology team if people have just got recurrent bouts of really watery diarrhea. And the second, just to be aware of, is that with fluorouracil / 5-FU / capecitabine, the same thing, there is an enzyme deficiency, which means patients are predisposed to toxicity. And I say that, I draw attention to that, because in New Zealand, we don't actually test for that enzyme deficiency. So the test is giving people the chemotherapy. And it's certainly more common in the Asian population, that deficiency. And patients get really awful mucositis, and they can get really awful, profuse, watery diarrhea that can, you know, eventuate and lead to them developing shock. And we had a patient in Taupo Hospital last year. She presented and she had her first dose of fluorouracil. She'd come in with diarrhea. She'd had some initial management. She was keen to go home. The team hadn't really thought too much of it because they thought, oh, chemo, diarrhea, they could two go hand in hand. And she presented 12 hours later, and she was just behind in liters. And by that stage, she needed quite aggressive resuscitation. And it was probably partly our poor education. So we meant to educate our patients really carefully to let us know if they've got diarrhea like that. But they get told so many things when they start chemo, it's hard to take all that information on board. The other thing to remember is to always consider infection, particularly if the diarrhea is carrying on late into the chemotherapy cycle. So you can't blame the chemo if it's 12 days down the track. You've got to think of other causes. And I've also had patients who thought they had diarrhea and treated as if they had diarrhea, but in fact, it was they've got so constipated that they just had overflow. So I think it's just an area to be careful of. And also, just speaking of the diarrhea, just a reminder about the immunotherapy. So I touched a lot on immunotherapy when I did the lung cancer talk, but most commonly used immunotherapy drugs in New Zealand are Keytruda generic name is pembrolizumab, funded for most, for both lung cancer and melanoma. So more and more use in New Zealand, and we'll see it for more and more cancers. So just remember those immune-mediated toxicities that can occur in any organ system, particularly lung, thyroid, skin, joints and bowel. So the patients who are on these treatments, they don't generally get much side effects. So if they're presenting with new breathlessness or new diarrhea and abdominal pain or joint pain, then you have to have a high suspicion that it's actually the Keytruda that's driving that, and you really need to get advice around that management. Anything relating back to those slides, Lucinda?
No.
I just wanted to share some of the tips and tricks that I learned from doing oncology for kind of 12 months. I think I got careful about not always blaming the cancer for causing the presentation. So most of the time it will be the malignancy, but it's not always. So don't forget your other aspects of medicine, the deranged thyroid function, the just a barn door pneumonia making people sick. And I think when you're talking to an oncologist, particularly if you have to end up talking to somebody who doesn't know the patient already, they want to know, when you're calling them up, they want to know the type and the stage of the cancer, when the patient last had a CT, what chemo they're on, what cycle they're in, what cycle and like what number cycle and where they are in their cycle. And that stuff, if anyone's doing half-decent letters, should be pretty easily accessible in letter form. And often the patients are pretty clued up on that stuff as well. And I think when you're trying to figure out what symptoms the patients have got and how that correlates to their cancer, thinking where the malignancy actually is and where their tumour burden lies. And I know that sounds so obvious, but it took me a while to really go hunting in their long CT reports for, could this pain be explained by their malignancy, and looking to see if they had rib involvement or was there a lesion in the proximal femur that could account for this pain? Because often there's clues that lie in where the tumour actually is metastasized to. And the other thing I came to appreciate was the extreme usefulness of dexamethasone. We use it really brilliant oncology for those who are at the end of their illness. And it can be really helpful for giving patients just a boost in their energy and in their appetite. And it just seems to diminish symptoms overall, would reduce their nausea. It doesn't work for everyone, but it can just give people a couple of weeks of a bit more energy at the end of their illness. There's downsides for sure as far as weakness and all the complications of steroid. But when you're looking at sort of a terminal phase of someone's life, you don't really need to dwell so much on those. So I think don't be afraid to utilise some dexamethasone when you're faced with that quite symptomatic end-stage oncology patient. You'll get that advice from oncologists a lot. They'll be like, have you tried some dexamethasone?
Just to highlight a couple of those side effects of dexamethasone, and I think it's useful to highlight to patients and their families. Some patients might be on longer-term low-dose everyday dex and the side effect of proximal myopathy and the impact that can have on mobilisation. So just highlighting that to them. And then also if they're a diabetic and how their blood sugars will go out of control and you'll need to use insulin. So if they've never been on insulin before, it may be a time when they have to become skilled in doing blood sugar levels and administering insulin. So, yeah, just to be aware of that too.
Yeah, and I think that's...
Oh, yeah, sorry.
I was just going to say that kind of comes to the point that you don't want to be using dexamethasone too liberally and too early on in someone's illness, because you don't want to leave them with awful side effects that then impair their kind of independence. The other thing I was going to say about dex was just to be aware that dexamethasone gets used a lot when people are on chemotherapy. So for a lot of chemotherapy regimens have dexamethasone in them, and it does just send people's diabetes up the whop. It's something to consider in your diabetic patients who are getting chemo that they may not be normally checking, but if they're presenting unwell, it may be that their sugars are contributing.
Yeah, perfect. Righty-ho. On that note, thank you very much, Matilda. That was great. And I think it just highlights, as you say, a lot of these on the rarer side, particularly rurally, we just don't see necessarily the density of patients that you'd see on an oncology ward when you're an oncology registrar. So it's great to highlight them and just to think about them and the management. So thank you very much, Matilda, on behalf of us all. And also thank you, Gary, for your part you've played this evening. I will look forward to seeing you later on this year. We're going to have an acute eye webinar in May, I think it's going to be. So I look forward to seeing you all then. Good evening.
Thank you.